And our next case, 063297, Product Specialties versus Mentor Systems. Mr. Evans, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. This appeal presents what we view to be a very important issue as to the role and responsibilities of a trial court in connection with instructing a jury as to the applicable law. While this is an adversarial system and lawyers are responsible for raising various issues with respect to jury instructions, the trial court does, or in our view, at least should have the responsibility to make sure it is conducted according to the law. That responsibility must extend to instructing the jury as to the correct law and the legal principles to be applied to the facts. The negligence of a party's trial counsel, and I would note that I was not trial counsel in this particular case, should not insulate or allow the trial court to abdicate its responsibilities.
So do you know the answer to this question? I recognize you weren't trial counsel. Why did counsel wait until after the trial to raise the argument relating to PSG's fraud claim, that the claim was barred by the economic loss doctrine?
Well, I think I would candidly tell the court that the economic loss doctrine was not raised as a specific affirmative defense. It was not raised in the words economic loss doctrine. However, and I would submit, Your Honor, that was due, frankly, to the negligence of trial counsel on behalf of Mensor. However, he did raise the concept of the economic loss doctrine when jury instructions were being discussed. And I think I referenced that was done at page, volume 9, page 966 of the transcript.
You know, he alluded to that, but of course he didn't make any specific request at that time. And, you know, the court can't just be clairvoyant in terms of a theory, a legal theory, and inject that into the instruction.
I agree with you, Your Honor. I wholeheartedly agree with that concept. However, I think in this case, as indicated in my reply brief, we would ask the court to apply the reasoning of the First Circuit concurring opinion. I think it was Judge Torelli who indicated that such issues ought to be able to be raised for the first time on appeal if they are generally only legal in nature and would not require a further exposition of the facts. And I think it's pretty clear from the record in this case that the economic loss doctrine under Wisconsin law would have barred the fraud claim because it was part and parcel of the contract issues involved.
And let's assume that we would agree with you and assume that the district court erred in allowing PSG to recover on its fraud claim now. How do you suggest we correct that error?
Well, I would suggest you correct that error by reversing and remanding with instructions to dismiss the fraud claim and retry the case on the contract theories of liability. Because the jury, it's possible, although there was no award on the contract claims. In fact, as I recall, although they found a breach of contract, they found no damages on the breach of contract. And I think it was just for purposes of fairness to PSG, it ought to be remanded with instructions to dismiss the fraud claim based upon the economic loss doctrine. And for a retrial of the contract claims.
What you're proposing, counsel, is highly unorthodox. The
I agree.
Economic loss doctrine should have been raised in a motion for summary judgment, and to allow it to be raised for the first time on appeal, because it's a legal issue, and it is a legal issue, but it's a legal issue that should have been raised on a motion for summary judgment or partial summary judgment to kick the fraud claim out of the case, and it wasn't, so you're stuck with that.
I agree. What I'm asking the court to do is unorthodox, and I'm asking the court to apply
the reasoning of one judge in another circuit.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor, and I am asking the court to utilize that that logic that Judge Torelli in the First Circuit
and make that
utilized.
The rule of law in the Seventh Circuit.
Well, it's
because your predecessor counsel was asleep at the switch.
Well, I am asking that, Your Honor.
Why is that a good rule?
Well, I think it's a good rule.
And particularly, let me just interject, because I'm concerned in this same area. I mean, you want a total retrial on the breach of contract claim. And you're not even, I mean, it would be enough to ask just for a retrial on the damages portion. But you, as I understand it, you want a total retrial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
The point that Judge Torelli made, I think, in his reasoning was is that there ought to be exceptions for particular sets of circumstances where a legal issue, like in the case that he dealt with, I believe it was the Chestnut case, that dealt with a governmental immunity issue which had not been raised at the lower court level. That governmental immunity issue clearly barred the plaintiff's claim.
Immunity is in a totally different category.
Well,
this is a legal issue that should have been raised by privately retained counsel, and the rule that you're proposing would encourage malpractice.
Well, I don't believe it would. You
know, your remedy is against the predecessor counsel.
I understand, Your Honor.
Because this puts us in a situation where, as Judge Sykes points out, anytime there's this kind of error or screw-up by the trial counsel, the Court of Appeals can come to the rescue if there's another grounds or basis to uphold the judgment or to give a second bite at the apple.
I understand your position, and I respect your position, and I don't have really much further to say on the point.
The burden of proof jury instruction is a little bit different, and I'd like to know whether your predecessor counsel actually submitted proposed jury instructions that contained the wrong burden, the preponderance burden, instead of clear and convincing.
Unfortunately, they did, Your Honor. Both counsels submitted jury instructions which included a burden of proof which provided for a preponderance of the evidence. As you'll note in the record, during a discussion of the jury instruction with respect to punitive damages, the trial court correctly in that case noted that the middle burden, that is the clear and convincing standard, was required to prove punitive damages. And it is our position that this presents, notwithstanding the negligence of counsel, this issue was raised in post-trial motions. This presents, I believe, an extremely good opportunity for this court to utilize and write on the issue of plain error as it applies in civil cases. I would submit that under Rule 51D2, you have to show basically three things. One, that there was an error. Two, that it was plain or obvious. And three, whether it affected the substantial rights of the party asserting the error. All parties agree that the jury instruction with respect to the burden of proof as to fraud was erroneous. It was a burden of proof instruction which provided for the preponderance of the evidence.
Well, didn't the punitive damages instruction that required the jury to find that Mincer acted in intentional disregard of PSG's rights by clear and convincing evidence cure any error in the juror's instructions for the finding of fraudulent inducement?
That's PSG's argument, Your Honor, and I would disagree. I think it did exactly the opposite. I think it created a confusing situation, and it highlighted the fact that the jury could apply the preponderance standard to the fraud claim, which was incorrect, and a more stringent standard to the punitive damage claim. It, in our view, frankly, highlighted the differences between the standards of burden of proof. And as a consequence, either led to confusion with the jury or provided a situation where the wrong burden of proof standard in the fraud case was emphasized.
Well, as I understand the defense in this case, it was, at least as to the fraud and the inducement claim, it was that there was no intent to defraud. And so given that the clear and convincing burden of proof was submitted to the jury on the punitives, which deal with an inquiry as to intent, why isn't that a cure, rather than confusing the jury that sustained the burden,
well,
or indicates that the jury felt that the case was proven to that requisite degree on the issue of intent, which was really the defense on the fraud claim?
Well, as Your Honor knows, there's a number of different elements to a fraud claim, and there were a number of defenses that were posited. First, there was the claim that there was no knowingly false statement made, and there was a great defense mounted with respect to the reliance aspect of the fraudulent inducement claim. As you will note in our briefs, PSG had claimed that we told them there was going to be 2 to 2.5 millimeters per side of the forging that was going to have to be removed. And they admitted in their reply brief that at the trial level, they knew before they signed the contract that more than 2 to 2.5 millimeters per side was going to have to be taken out, and they knew that triple their anticipated time was taken. This was all before they signed the contract. So the issue of reliance, I mean, they knew the facts. The issue of reliance was significant at the trial level, and the burden of proof applies to all elements of the fraud claim. So I wouldn't necessarily agree that because the intent issue may have been correctly discussed in giving instructions with respect to the punitive damage claim, that it cured the issue with respect to all of the other elements with respect to the fraud claim. And I think it's important for the credibility of the court system that the jury assess the facts based upon the correct standard of proof. And it's very difficult for us to now get into the minds of the jury that in determining whether or not they would have had a different result with respect to the burden of proof. Clear and convincing is a much more stringent standard in civil cases than a mere preponderance of the evidence. And I would submit that the judge should have known. I think PSG's counsel did know, because he was an experienced litigator, that it's clear that the burden of proof in fraud cases is clear and convincing. I just want to touch upon, for a moment, the punitive damages aspect of the case. Appellee PSG has suggested that we are arguing that an erroneous instruction was given. We're not arguing that an erroneous instruction was given regarding the punitive damages. We're arguing that on the facts, no instruction should have been given and the issue should not have gone to the jury. That was the argument that Minsource Trial Counsel made at the trial during the jury instruction issues. There was, at trial, no showing of an intentional or willful disregard of PSG's rights when making the alleged fraudulent misrepresentation, and I think this is an important point. I think that the focus has to be on when they allege the representation was made. As I've noted before, PSG knew before it signed the contract that extra stock, that the alleged misrepresentation was false. Therefore, they didn't have a reasonable right to rely upon it. Next, PSG claimed that, well, we told them that there could be changes to the forging, at the time they signed the contract. Well, they knew that was a possibility of changes. There's dispute over the evidence with respect to what actually transpired there. But PSG knew, admitted that it knew, no later than 8 days later after it signed the contract, that there would be no change, that no changes could be made to the forgings. I would submit that the focus must be on contract formation or near contract formation as to whether or not there was a willful disregard of the party's rights. And I'd like to reserve any further time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fuhrer? All right.
May it please the court, my name is Pete Fuhrer. I represent plaintiff appellee PSG. Just have a couple brief points that I want to make, and your honors, you touched on them in the argument that you just heard. First issue, first point is waiver. None of the arguments that appellant's counsel made in the briefs, and none of the arguments that he discussed here today, were ever raised at a jury instruction conference, and they were never raised at the close of the evidence. A jury awarded damages for PSG. At that time, appellant got new counsel, and new counsel raised these arguments for the first time in a post-trial motion. Judge Clavert heard these arguments at a post-trial hearing, and Judge Clavert stated he was in total agreement with PSG that the arguments had been waived. And that brings me to my second point. Judge Clavert then added that putting the issue of waiver aside, he was rejecting Minzer's arguments on the grounds that the evidence in this case was not even close. And those were Judge Clavert's own words. The evidence in this case was not close. Judge Clavert then took appellant's counsel to task a bit for bringing an insufficiency of the evidence argument without examining the record to see what evidence was actually introduced at trial. Because of the issues of waiver, because the evidence in this case was not even close, I ask that you affirm Judge Clavert's decisions in all respects. I'll defer for questions now.
I just had one question. This relates to this judgment notwithstanding the verdict. In what way was PSG prejudiced by Minzer's failure to renew its motion for judgment as a matter of law at the close of all the evidence?
I think the case law establishes that even if there is no prejudice, it is required that a party renew their motion at the close of all the evidence pursuant to Rule 50B. And I believe the case law in the Seventh Circuit is clear on that point. And the policy rationale is that it allows a plaintiff an opportunity to present more evidence if needed. Whether there's prejudice or not, that's the rule. The Seventh Circuit applies that rule. And we have cited Seventh Circuit decisions on that point, Your Honor.
Any questions?
Just about the preponderance jury instruction on the burden of proof on the fraud claim, was this ever discussed among counsel and the judge? I mean, how did this happen?
I can't answer that. I was there at the jury instruction conference for part of it. I know that we submitted a burden of proof instruction for patterns of the evidence. It was never brought up. I talked to Mike Abrahamian, the partner on this case. It was never raised by either party. That's all I know. We submitted the preponderance of the evidence instruction. There was no objection given pursuant to Rule 51.
It's a fairly obvious error under clearly established Wisconsin law.
And review, if any, would be limited to plain error in a civil case, and that's a very tough standard to meet. And as you alluded to in the earlier argument, we believe that the punitive damages instruction cured any error in that the jury was given a clear and convincing burden of proof instruction with respect to punitive damages.
Well, and your opposing counsel makes the point that that may have mitigated any prejudice on the defense as to intent to defraud, but that there was a vigorous defense mounted to the reasonableness of reliance on the facts here. And if the jury found that element of the claim only to a preponderance, then that's in the nature of a structural error. And certainly in a criminal case, a burden of proof error is structural.
You have
a response to that argument?
I agree. I disagree with the argument. I agree that's the argument that they're making. I think the argument on reliance...
So you agree that I correctly stated their argument?
Right.
Okay.
I believe they waived that argument. Review, if any, is limited to plain error in this case.
So how is that not a plain error that affects the substantial rights of the party and the fairness and integrity of the proceedings?
Because we believe that reliance, there was reasonable reliance given the standard of review. As Judge Clavert said, the evidence in this case was not even close.
Yeah, but he didn't analyze that. He just said, I agree with you folks, and the evidence was not close, end of story.
Well, when you look at the evidence and all the reasonable inferences that can be drawn from it in the light most favorable to PSG, that conclusion can be reached. PSG had to rely on these misrepresentations in order to submit a quotation.
Well, you had the knowledge that the representation about the amount of material that would have to be removed from the forging was incorrect. So you knew it was inaccurate. You knew it was false.
We knew
you discussed it.
We knew it was inaccurate in early April. And
Before
the contract was signed. And we brought that to Minzer's attention. And Minzer told PSG that those were the prototype forgings, that the production forgings would be different. We relied on that representation.
And how is that reasonable? Why didn't you write that into the contract before you signed it?
Because we had no reason to not believe them. PSG had been in business a long time, never had to sue a customer, was never involved with the lawsuit. They had no reason not to believe Minzer, that these were prototype forgings, that
so
the production forgings...
That doesn't answer my question. Why didn't your client write that equivocation into the contract? If everybody knew that the forging that was being worked on at the time was not a real prototype and that there would be changes, then it's your obligation as a sophisticated commercial contracting party to put that in the contract before you sign it.
Again, the testimony at trial was that they asked Minzer, before they signed the contract, are these assumptions still accurate, the 2 to 2.5 millimeters of material to remove, notwithstanding what we saw with the prototype forgings? They posed that question to Minzer. Minzer said, these are just the prototype forgings. The production forgings will be different.
So
they did raise that issue. They didn't put it in writing, but they did raise that issue with Minzer, and they were given an answer.
So why didn't your client put that in writing before signing the contract, since everybody knew that there were going to be some changes or assumed that there were going to be some changes?
They did not feel it was necessary. They were told that there would be changes.
How
and to
is
them,
that
the
commercially
issue...
reasonable and enough to sustain a fraud claim? You know, I view this as not a close case for you, but as a close case for the other side. This is a very weak fraud claim.
Again, they got the evidence, they were told there would be changes, and they took Minzer at their word. And in retrospect, that was a mistake, but they, at the time, had no reason to believe that there would be fraudulent misrepresentation.
And did nothing to protect themselves by writing this new understanding into the contract before signing it.
Correct.
And on that basis, stood up in front of a jury and said what we did was absolutely reasonable. And apparently the jury believed you, but only to a preponderance.
Well, when they heard the whole story about Minzer being in a bind, they needed these prototypes. They had a new customer, Axle Alliance. They had never worked with steering knuckles before. They had 3 weeks to provide prototypes to Axle, and they didn't even have a vendor lined up yet who could provide the prototypes. There was a very tight timeline. Minzer had already approached two vendors who had said, no, we can't do it in that short amount of time. Minzer needed PSG. In order to get PSG on board, they misrepresented the facts as to how much work PSG would need to do. And they fraudulently induced PSG to enter into the contract to PSG's detriment.
What was the measure of damages in this case?
I believe the jury came back with an award of...
Not how much. What was the measure?
A couple of different theories were presented to the jury. One was substantial performance for the contract.
That was on the breach claim.
That was on the breach. And out of pocket for the fraud claim.
Change of position damages on the fraud claim?
Correct.
So you were both affirming the contract and suing for contract damages and rescinding and suing for restitutionary damages?
Correct, Your Honor.
And how is that not inconsistent?
Minzer was, their defense at trial was that the 2 to 2.5 millimeters was not part of the contract. And that was their basis for defending the breach of contract claim. And we went at it saying, well, we believe it is part of the contract, but alternatively, if it's not part of the contract, we were fraudulently induced and entering into.
But fraud and inducement requires an election of remedies, usually, anyway. I mean, it appears this is perhaps another way that the defendant's predecessor counsel was asleep at the switch, but you know, usually you can't have it both ways.
And I believe after the damages came back to see what the damages were, then there would be an election of whether we would recover the tort damages or the contract damages.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time?
4.5.
Evans, 4.5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll make that 4.5 minutes easy. I don't have any further comments unless you have any further questions. Thank you very much.
And thank you to both counsel for their fine arguments. We'll take the case under advisement.